Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
It's the Gift Planning Development Podcast. I'm your host today, Joe Tumalo. And we've been doing a number of board member topics. It's something that's I get a lot of requests for, and there's a lot of talk about it, and everybody talks about their board. And when most organizations talk about the board, it's around frustration that they're not doing enough, they're not fundraising oriented enough, it's hard to get good board members, right? All those challenges. And my guest today is somebody that I work pretty closely with, and really smart guy. He's had a lot of experience, a lot of higher ed experience, and he's going to give a real great case study of a college that he was very, very involved with, helping them really redefine and rethink the way they recruit and manage board members. And Chris Cloud is my guest. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks so much, Joe. A real pleasure to be with you today.
Well, I know my listeners are going to get a lot out of the podcast. No pressure now, but I'm sure they will.
Okay. And set the bar high.
Yeah. Well, you absolutely. You said it when we first met. And so you're mostly a New York guy, right?
Mostly. I've been in New York for 25 years. I'm not a native New Yorker, but I've acclimated.
Very well, I would say. And you practice law. Did you practice law in New York or somewhere else as well?
I practiced law in New York at a private firm on Wall Street, and did mostly defense work for agencies of the Archdiocese. A couple of big cases, one of the few cases with regard to AIDS and diagnosis of AIDS, and a big case about constitutional issues surrounding foster care, and that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
Incredible. And so how did you make that transition to fundraising?
Well, in law, you get to a place where you want an equity stake in the firm or have your own law firm. And so I had a partner I was looking to open up a law firm with. And we decided that before we jumped from our day job into an entrepreneurial situation with a new firm, we would go around to all our clients and kind of canvas, could we expect business from you? How much? What would it look like? And in the course of doing that, I talked with some people at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and they were about to embark on an incredible adventure in a huge, actually two huge campaigns. And what was unusual about it, Joe, is they were going to run two campaigns, one for Cornell Medical College and one for New York Presbyterian Hospital, all out of the same fundraising office, a joint fundraising office. So they were worried about how they would do that, whose prospects are mine, whose are yours. Then HIPAA was coming online, which was going to restrict healthcare fundraisers' ability to access certain information about, patient information. I was induced to come on and help with that campaign, and I had in my responsibilities raising money for stem cell disciplines. Fascinating, new heady stuff. And I found a donor who was actually a board member on the medical college who wanted to do something different, something that was really impactful. And I introduced him to a sort of wild-eyed researcher who would show you stem cells and cancer cells in petri dishes. And I got a major gift, a $15 million gift to form a stem cell center. Unlike the law, Joe, where it's a constant conflict. You go in and every discovery motion, you argue, you go up on appeal, you argue, and things move glacially, ever so slowly, and you're fighting all the time. Well, in fundraising, it's alignment. It's all, there's a donor and he wants to help this cause, and the cause could sure use the money. And so in that case, it was 6 weeks and the architect show up for the new stem cell center. And I just thought, oh my goodness, this is unbelievable. And so it went from sort of an interesting pivot on a law career to a full-time profession.
So your first major gift that you raised was $15 million?
No. There were other smaller ones as I was learning the chops, but that was within the first 18 months that started to come together. And I will tell you that although the architect showed up 6 weeks after we closed the gift, it was 7 or 8 months of negotiation about, you know, the gift agreement and back to your attorneys and back to my attorneys before the thing got done. So it wasn't zipped up quite as quickly as my description might have made it sound.
That's great. And so you've worked at you mentioned the one place that you were involved in, you're a Presbyterian, and you worked at Cornell Medical College. And then did you start in healthcare and then go into higher ed from there?
Yeah, I got recruited. I got a call from Corn Ferry after I'd been at New York Presbyterian for 5 years, and they were looking for a chief development officer at one of the schools in the CUNY system, you know, Baruch College in Gramercy. And a dynamic new woman president there who was looking to do interesting things. And I was hesitant because I had learned all about HIPAA. I helped co-author the compliance plan for HIPAA. I was training a bunch of people. And to sort of leave that to go into higher ed was daunting. But it opened up whole new vistas. You go from a dynamic where grateful patient is one of the primary motivations to a world where it's higher education. And in some sense, I found it even more altruistic because you had people certainly coming out of Baruch College, which is, City University, which is public school. And you have people who are coming out of there who have done well and are in a position to make gifts. And there's a high degree of altruism that they see in themselves, the students today at the school. They say, well, I have to do something. But for Baruch College, I wouldn't be where I am, and I need to give back. And so that was a whole different and very rewarding dimension and allowed me, you know, some vantage into both areas of fundraising.
Great. And so within that work, you honed your chops around board member development and things we're going to
talk about. Yeah, well, you know, so my premise really is that every nonprofit is looking for help. They could use some more money. They could use good employees. They could use people saying good things about them. And of course, they all need board members. And to me, finding, attracting, pursuing, and convincing people to come and join your board is quintessential to what you do. And my premise is that if you think about it, if you're not able to approach a sophisticated stranger or quasi-stranger or a lapsed donor and convey them in a personable, convincing way why your nonprofit is worthwhile for their involvement, how are you going to raise any money? So my premise with board development is that it's intrinsically linked to major gifts, and that if you can do one well, board development or major gifts, you can do the other well. But if you can't do one well, there's a problem with the other that you're not realizing.
Mm. So there are plenty of people who do really well with major gifts generally, but aren't doing well with their board, right?
Exactly. So, in my experience, most nonprofits, they source board development out most commonly. They'll look around the room amongst their board member colleagues and say, hey, who do you know who could serve? And a name comes up and it sounds good. And they say, great, why don't you, there's your job. Go and convince them to join the board. Sometimes they'll source a company, Joe, and there's a lot of these companies around now that for fee will source a board member and then drop them into a chair next to you. But my premise is that if you do have a major gifts program, that should inform how you're sourcing board members.
How so?
Well, most organizations take it for granted that they need more board members. You know, new board members, there's so many obvious benefits that you know so well. There's more hands on deck. It evolves the culture of your board. It gives you more resource for opinions, more talent, more range of contacts, more opportunities for fundraising. But so I'm saying there's another structural reason why you need to pay attention to board development. It's a corollary to major gifts fundraising. And I think that what you need to do and what most organizations ought to do to get maximum benefit and match maximum mutual support of both those functions, and do them in tandem. So you should be researching for potential board members with the right characteristics in the same way that you research for potential major gifts prospects. And you should be using your moves management discipline that you use on a weekly basis to drive, you know, persistent, deliberative action to get in front of people for major gifts, and use that to make a connection and advocate as well for your board members, your prospective board members. So I'm talking about a close collaboration between the major gifts moves management function and the governance committee of your board. So instead of leaving it to the governance committee to dream up and source these people, the governance committee is working hand in glove with the major gifts function to research, figure out strategies of approach, and constructively approach people who could be board members.
And if we're not leading the board, they're not going to, I mean, people are busy, right? I mean, they're relying on us to be proactive in this way, don't you think?
Well, yeah, there's no question. And it's something where your success here strengthens, it provides your development and major gifts function with more exposure. The board sees it more clearly, has more of an understanding what it does, because there's a cross connect with your governance committee. And the success of finding board members through moves management discipline is a shared success. And it illuminates what you do well in major gifts. It illuminates the best aspects. It sharpens the best talking points. It moves board members closer to that practice of approaching people and serving as an ambassador for your nonprofit that explains who you are and what you do and why it's worthwhile and why someone should be a part of that.
So if we were to just throw out a couple overall steps to take to move towards this, maybe we can throw out three or five. I'm thinking number one might be define your ideal board member profile.
Yeah, it's very helpful. And a lot of sophisticated nonprofits, you know, they'll audit their board in some formal or informal way. So, you know, okay, how are we doing with diversity? How are we doing with gender diversity? And most could do better, as you know. How are we doing with expertise? We got four lawyers. How are we with financial literacy? How are we with marketing? And so if you kind of take a look at what you have and consider what you lack, it comes into focus pretty quickly what could help a more fulsome bank of talent and ability.
And then how would you take it deeper? I just did another podcast with a consultant here in Philadelphia, Valerie Jones, and I liked what one of the things that she really focuses on is personality and style of the board member.
Yep.
So if you have, let's say, an introverted analytic type of personality, well, we need people
right.
like that, versus if everybody's like the extrovert, high level, don't bother me with the details type of person, it's going to make it much more challenging. So to leverage the differences, you know, our friend Brian Sagristano, actually founded our company, Get Planning Development. He and I were very, very different styles. He's more of an analytic introvert, and I'm more of an intuitive extrovert.
That is true. That's insightful.
Right. But the clients loved it because when we worked together, because we each brought our own skill sets and personalities and disciplines to the mix. And where if I struggle more with the details, and so he was able to kind of double check my details, and he didn't enjoy, really hearing fundraisers whine about why they're not making more calls and getting more gifts. And I love doing that. So it was that blend. So with board members, I like that idea of let's take a look at personality wise. Do we have people that are able to, some people, not that introverts can't go out and ask for money, right? Of course they can. They're just going to do that in a different way. And they might be more comfortable doing that with other introverts as well, donors.
No question. And that's a whole other very interesting qualitative layer on the question of who would be an ideal board member. But, you know, Joe, what I always like to emphasize is board members shouldn't have to be faced with the, daunted and intimidated by the idea, we need to recruit people who can go out and ask for money. Mm. I think ideally a major gift solicitation, you go in pairs. You don't chicken out that way. You're mutually supporting. Yeah. And if you have a volunteer leader, a board member who is respected by the donor prospect and can endorse the process, then you don't need to make the ask. Your staff member can make sure that that's done and relieve the board member. Some board members like to, I hate to worry board members that that's going to be something that they're going to have to come up against if that is a worry.
Hmm. Good. What will be the next step? So we identify, how many
target group? Yeah, sure. And then there's a conversation between the nominating committee, who has this intelligence and insight about who would be good for the board, with the chief development officer or the major gifts function, to talk about how that gets operationalized. And then what happens is the same process that is used to source prospective major donors is expanded and augmented to include prospective board members. Now the research function, the more informal who knows who, the looking at records, that function is applied professionally through the development office to help build a list, which is then reviewed periodically with the governance committee I know that person, or I'll ask people on the board if they know that person, so that every advantage is invoked. But importantly, the names that are decided upon are included in what should be weekly discipline, campaign style, weekly moves management discipline, that you're reviewing the names and you're saying, okay, what did we say we were going to do last week to move this prospect forward? And what did we actually do? And what's going to get done next week? So that week by week, you're moving it forward. We want to invite them and see if we can get them in the room so they get a visceral sense of what we do here. We want to connect them with the executive director. Whatever that series of meaningful steps looks like, it needs to be driven. It needs urgency and it needs persistence, as you well know, Joe. And that's what major gifts people do for a living. So to embed that into their process gives you the benefits. It illuminates for the board how that process works constructively, and it produces dividends in prospective board members moving to conversation level about the possibility that they may become board members.
But Chris, we need our major gifts people out there closing gifts. They don't have time to spend on this board member development stuff.
Well, I feel that there's a direct and organic overlap between the two. First of all, a board member who comes on is going to be a donor. Unless you've done something quite wrong or haven't made your expectations clear. Secondly, not all board member prospects are going to become board members. If they're not board members, then the outreach and the introduction process, inuring these individuals to the value of what your nonprofit does, puts them in a position to become major gifts donors.
That's a big point.
Well, that's exactly right. Plus, think of now you have a rationale that's quite elevated when you're thinking, how do I get in front of this person? If it's a dynamic, Joe, where you're thinking, I need to get in front of them because they can do something for us. They can make a gift for us. That's a difficult dynamic. You need to find a reason why it's good and important for the donor. And there can be no less flattering, less important reason than, well, you're someone we'd like to talk with about joining our board. That kind of approach is a five-star approach. It gives you so much more to work with than, there's a really interesting thing you might be interested in. I saw that you gave to a similar organization. To say, and I'll describe for you with real examples from some well-known institutions how this works in real life. But an outreach program where you're saying, I would like to schedule a meeting with you, ma'am or sir, and our president to talk about X nonprofit. That's a meeting that's going to get picked up a lot more quickly. And it's a meeting that has a lot more power and potential for success than, oh, won't you please come to our gala? Mm. Or just about any other garden variety approach a major gift officer might use to lure somebody in.
Great. And any suggestions on how to track the different, you mentioned the moves management. Are you tracking that in Razor's Edge or Banner or whatever they might be using and just coding them as a different?
You have to. Joe, it is, as soon as your organization grows that you have more than, you know, a dozen prospects, no ordinary mortal can keep all the details in their head about, you know, these are the prospects and these are the moves that we want and these are the contact points. So it needs to be fed and nourished into a donor database. And that is, you know, that is the elemental resource for everybody. For, you know, for mnemonics, when's the last time I reached out? What's the name of the executive secretary? What's the birthday? As well as, you know, succession management. Somebody leaves, you know, development people, average tenure of a major gifts officer at New York Presbyterian Hospital, which is you know, a great place to work and a great place to have on a resume. But they only last, major gifts officers, typically 2 years. So people are going to come and they're going to go. So all the information, all the insight from contacts, from investigation, all the progress has to be fed into a database. So it's additive that if someone leaves, if someone changes responsibility, the next person can come slot right in and take up where the last person left off.
Makes sense. So you do have, you mentioned you have a great real world case study example.
I do. Yeah. So the Cooper Union in New York City is certainly well known in the East Coast. It is a small school that teaches art and architecture and engineering. Those are the three disciplines. And historically, it has been free. There's been a big endowment. Some people know the name because the seminal campus building, the Great Hall, was where Abraham Lincoln spoke famously in the right makes might speech that he gave in the 1860 campaign before he won the nomination from the Republican Party and won the presidency. So it's a famous place. It's a very small school. They had a dilapidated engineering building, Joe, and they were coming up for accreditation 30 years ago and felt they needed a new building. 20 years ago, and so they decided to build a new building, and the premise would be that it would be based on a campaign, fundraising campaign, and somebody would name the building $250 million. Well, the fundraising plan wasn't as good as it needed to be, and they didn't raise the money on pace that they needed to raise. And so to pay the contractors and to move ahead on timeline, they had to borrow money. And this was right before the downturn. Mm. They have wonderful assets. They actually, Cooper Union owns the land under the Chrysler building. So they're the landlord of the Chrysler building. But their assets in the downturn all tanked, and they found themselves in a very precarious financial situation. A new president came on a few years later and realized that, looking at the finances, that they only had 3 years of solvency, and that he would not even be able to graduate a full class with the money that was available from the time that he assumed the presidency. So they developed a highly controversial plan to start charging partial tuition on a sliding scale so that people who had a family household income less than the national average, $54,000, they would still receive free tuition as always, but people above that would be asked to pay half tuition. Well, this was extremely controversial. The alumni of Cooper Union felt that that was in derogation of the spirit of the school, and that if you don't earn a place in the class and earn free tuition, that's just not the right formula. And they became very aggrieved and filed a lawsuit in New York court to put a stop to this. The board became polarized, the board became a place where people were either in support of the tuition plan or they were opposed to the tuition plan. And not, Joe, not unlike our politics today, it became increasingly polarized and increasingly divisive. And what was worse, in this moment of need where board leadership and fundraising was so important as an example and as a revenue source, the folks on the board just weren't in a position. A lot of people fell away and they weren't in a position to make large gifts. So we decided on a plan to try to build the board. The president who instituted the tuition plan left. We had an acting president. I was the acting vice president of development at the time. It's a role I take from time to time, and it's usually only 3 or 6 months until they hire somebody. This was a two-year tenure for me just because they were in such upheaval. And what we did is we started to imagine people for the board based on conversations with the governance committee that would be helpful in terms of the culture, in terms of coming in and raising the bar for potential to give. And most importantly, we were looking for non-alumni because we didn't want people to come in with the same polarized mentality that was causing such problems on the board. So, if you know higher education, nonprofit fundraising, it's really hard to raise money from people who didn't go to your school. They're not really stakeholders. Non-alumni donors, that, you know, very rare. Sometimes there's a few on the board, but it doesn't happen that often. So what we did is we leveraged the name recognition of the school and the power of what the school does in the three areas where it teaches. And we looked for people who had done well in art and engineering and in architecture. And we created a shortlist. And we did an outreach, an outreach program driven through the Major Gifts Office. And it essentially, so there was an outreach letter, congratulations for your wonderful success in, pick your poison, architecture, real estate. We know of you through maybe a person that put us onto them, or because, you know, insert your rationale, because we've seen the articles in the paper, the wonderful article, so-and-so, you were just honored by the such-and-such society. It's a new day at Cooper Union. We're working on things we never could have imagined just a few months ago, and we're looking for people who can give us insight and advice about how to proceed. Would like to schedule a meeting with our acting president. Would you be amenable? And then I called, and then so I would report weekly.
Calls, Chris? I mean, these are just calls.
It's similar. Similar to how you might recruit an advisory committee. Mm-hmm. It's similar to an aggressive approach for new donors, high level donors, where a letter is sent with a request, and then you follow up with a telephone, and you get an executive secretary who puts a dead stop to you and says, "I don't remember receiving that letter." Mm-hmm. And then you you talk to them, and you get their name, and you talk about their vacation. And you you offer to email a PDF of the letter, and then you ask if you can call back the next day, and you call back. And sometimes you can't get through, and sometimes you can't. But most often, it at least gets in front of the individual that you're trying to reach. There's this letter from Cooper Union. What do you think of this? And you get a sounding. And in our case, it was more often successful than not. We had about 9 meetings. And there were 3 people we put forward to the nominating committee, and 2 people joined the board. All non-alumni, all people capable of giving 6-figure gifts, whereas most people on the board were more typically giving 4-figure gifts.
Hmm. So what was your percentage rate from the people you approached to the people you said you got 9 visits or 9 conversations?
I think it was 16 to 18 that we sent letters to. It was more than 50% that we got a willingness to meet. And this is a function of, these are all New York City people. Mm-hmm. These are all people in with success or professional affiliation in one of the 3 disciplines where the school teaches, art, engineering, or architecture. So, you know, people who go through Cooper Union in New York City, graduate, go into those fields, it's you have a lot of name recognition. So anybody in those fields, if they didn't go to Cooper Union themselves, and none of these people did, they would have heard about the school because of the name value of the school, or because of people in the profession who carry our banner, who went through the program and go into the workplace and nourish and improve the standards and achievements in that area of pursuit.
That's incredible. And so you had two board members came out of that.
Yep.
And then
who took meetings with us, mm-hmm. but declined or for whatever reason didn't want to come on the board, remained Major Gifts prospects. My 2-year stint ended, gosh, I've been out of there 2 years now. A great new president came in, Laura Sparks, who's a remarkable woman, and they have a full-time vice president of development there. So I don't know firsthand how the success rate of the Major Gifts of the board prospects who became Major Gifts prospects. I don't know where that went, but they've been raising good amount of money, and I'm sure having another six. Capable Major Gifts prospects who have received high level outreach introducing Cooper Union to them. I'm sure they had a little bit of tailwind in their efforts.
It's remarkable. So what are some takeaways for your, let's say like a mid-size nonprofit organization, could be social, let's say like a social service organization, want to build up the board. So we talked about make sure you define your ideal board member profile.
Yep.
Right? And be diverse in your criteria. We talked about style, personality, as well as
right.
skill sets.
That's right.
And then treat them just like you would Major Gift prospects. If you're using Razor's Edge, put them in there. And I would assume create a constituent code for in Razor's Edge for board member prospect.
Board prospect. That's right.
And then it's everybody's
responsibility. So you can isolate them and look at that list whenever you need to.
Yep. And make them part of your weekly, biweekly pipeline meetings, right?
That's it. And so consider the benefits package here. If you pay attention to your board development function and have a good sense of standards about the kind of people who would benefit the board, then think what you're going to get. You're going to grow the size of your board productively. You're going to bring new blood that reduces your board terms, reduces long-term carryover board service, which a lot of organizations get because they have difficulty sourcing board members and they got to keep everybody they have. You're going to rotate board leadership positions more frequently. You're going to sharpen all your recruitment documentation and presentation, because you're going to road test it. You're going to go out and you're going to use it. It's not going to sit on a shelf or be something that you have not used for 3 or 4 years. You're going to improve your board member handbook and related resources. Your onboarding process. You're going to grow your contact bank. You're going to grow the collective skill and intelligence of the board member body. And you're going to sharpen your Major Gifts functioning that increases your fundraising. All this package of benefits can come from this sort of hybrid, collaborative means of pursuing, identifying and pursuing potential board members in collaboration with your Major Gifts functioning.
So let's say we are a social service organization and we're going to go out and find people like you did at Cooper Union. Where do we start? Where would we be looking?
Well, you should identify the people that you think would be good for board service, as we've talked about a little, and you're going to dream a little. What about so and so? What about so and so? And certainly, the nominating committee, any free associative direction finding they can provide. But I always thought about so and so would be a board member. And what I'm suggesting is that you leap beyond just the people you know or that somebody on your board knows, to the what about this sort of dream world of what about these people? You can look at other boards that go into Charity Navigator, and Charity Navigator will show you the different nonprofits that are related to other nonprofits through their coding and their function. And looking through the board membership of other organizations is something that's very instructive about, for ideas about who might serve on your board. Some nonprofits are willing to make outreach to encourage people at competing boards to consider them as well, which, you know, people may or may not do. But certainly to get a meeting with a prominent person on a board of a nonprofit that's on a peer organization that you admire will at the very least enable you to have a conversation with them about the range of people, not necessarily on the competing board, who might be interested and might be induced, perhaps even with some door opening on the part of the person you're interviewing, to be added to the list of folks who you might consider for your board. So, you know, the old adage, if you want advice, ask for money. Mm-hmm. But if you want money, ask for advice. When you go to people saying, we really could use the benefit of your experience, we really value and could use and put to work your ideas and your map of contacts in this space, that is typically, not always, but typically flattering to people. People who serve on boards, they're on boards because they want to help. There's some part of them that wants to be helpful. And if they care about that social services space, even if they're on a competing board, it is not beyond the pale that they would speak with you and advise you and give you some illumination about the kinds of people you might be able to approach and maybe even some help doing so.
Yes. Good stuff, Chris.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. Sounds simple, but not easy, right? I mean, it's a lot of work, but certainly the payoffs are many.
Well, it's not any extra work, really, because the major gifts officers are working up the best prospects. If we're talking about board prospects who could also be major gifts prospects, then it's not any double duty for them. And in fact, as we discussed earlier, it gives them a really great approach to get somebody's attention and to get an initial meeting. We'd like to consider you for the board, or we'd like to talk with you about the future of our organization and get your advice. We'd like to introduce you to our executive director. That's a straight shot kind of approach that could really be helpful to major gifts officers. So I would argue that it's a benefit to major gifts officers, and it's a mutual benefit to the nominating committee. And except in the situation, which has got to be rare, of a nonprofit that doesn't need any board members and couldn't benefit from people who give more money than are on the board right now and couldn't benefit from a larger contacts bank. Except for that rare example, that unicorn, I think this is helpful to most nonprofits in a number of ways.
Hmm. Anything else that you want to highlight?
No, I want to thank you for the opportunity, Joe. And I enjoy working with you and enjoy your thoughtful approach and your curious consideration of these kinds of, maybe asymmetric approaches to doing things. It's important for fundraisers to continually be creative and to find different ways, different pathways to success for the nonprofits that we serve.
Well, thanks for adding value to our program. So how can people get in touch with you, and under what circumstances should they get in touch with you? What type of...
If I can be helpful, I spend a lot of time over coffee with folks that I know who find me on LinkedIn and are interested in what they see, and that doesn't have to come bundled with a retainer. I'm happy to be as helpful as I can. So you can certainly find me online at the firm I work with and work with you with. Joe is Constellation Advancement. So constellationadvancement.com sets out what we do and who's in the organization and the contact information there. My email, direct email, is chris@constellationadvancement.com. And I would be happy to hear from anybody.
And to be clear, you are doing board work, direct board work. That's something that you help people with and are always looking to help find people that need your help.
I do that. Mm-hmm. I do interim nonprofit leadership. If you're lacking a chief development officer, I've done six or seven of those in as many years, where I come in for a short period of time while you find a permanent vice president and help with the board, making sure that everything, that there's revenue continuity, making sure You know, if there are good people on board, that in the interim that you don't lose them, or sometimes, you know, you want restructuring before the permanent person comes on, and I'll do that. Also do a lot of campaign work, Joe, and I've been doing a lot of that recently, where, you know, you're trying to figure out if you have the game for a major campaign, perhaps a feasibility and planning study, perhaps a more discrete pulsing study to get a sense, an informed sense, sometimes, you know, SurveyMonkey outreach to get a broader sense, so that the board feels that they have a professionally informed viewpoint of whether a campaign's realistic, and what the plan would look like, the prospects would look like, the timeline would look like, the target amount would look like. And so I do some work in that space as well.
Terrific. Well, Chris, thanks again. And this has been the Gift Planning Development Podcast. My guest today, Chris Cloud. Until next time.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.